Before we begin the lecture, I just want to put in a plug for the Austrian Student Scholars Conference that we host annually at Grove City College. It will be February 18th and 19th. You can submit papers to me to come to Grove City College and present your research papers in a regular conference format. We usually have 25 or so students that come from different universities across America and some foreign countries. We put them together in different panels and have a discussion. We have two keynote speakers. Dr. Joseph Salerno will be one, and Dr. Bob Murphy will be the other this year. We also have cash prizes for the best papers, $1,000 for first place, $750 for second, and $500 for third. We also pay travel stipends. So if you're interested in this, I'll have some flyers on the table downstairs in the foyer, and you can pick one of those up, or just Google Austrian Student Scholars Conference, and you'll see our website. Okay, this lecture, we're going to talk about the connection between value and price, and we might mention once again in different terms the starting point for the Austrians and how it differs from other schools of thought. So the mainstream economists begin with just empirical observations. So they begin with observable facts. What can we know? Prices and quantities and production systems and profits and losses and so on and so forth. The Austrians also, of course, begin with the empirical world, but they add something to this mere empirical knowledge. And this is what Murray Rothbard liked to call a reflective knowledge. And so the Austrians bring together, at the beginning point of the analysis, what we can know about human action because we are human beings by reflecting upon the meaning of action, and what we know by observation of the real world. So from our perspective, the mainstream economists start with one hand tied behind their back. They start with only half of what they could know, or do in fact know, about human action. And of course, the other problem is, if you start with one hand tied behind your back, you tend to punch yourself in the kidneys, right? I mean, right? If you leave out the important part, the human part of the subject, but what we can know reflectively about acting, then what you conclude about observational facts might be misleading, or it's at least incomplete. Okay, so we want to cover two areas in this talk. The first is about valuation, what Dr. Salerno just spoke about in marginal utility. We want to carry that through, that idea of marginal utility, through to the determination of prices. And what we'll focus on is evaluation in decision-making, evaluation in choice. So we want to run through the logic of the process of deciding what ends to pursue, what means to apply to the attainment of these ends from the viewpoint of the human person valuing things, you know, assigning a purpose and motive and want desire to particular ends. And then we'll deal with what Mises likes to call appraisement. And appraisement is the same problem. We have to have a theory to explain how we make decisions about human action. What ends do we choose? What means do we apply? And so on, across the range of possibilities to acquire value, to have our wants satisfied in society, in a division of labor. And perhaps you can see immediately the problem or the difference between doing this in a division of labor and doing it as an individual person. The difference is, as an individual person, the person himself is both the consumer and producer. So if I make a choice between watching a movie or reading a book, then I'm combining both the means under my control and the ends that I'm formulating in my own mind and choosing between. But if I'm in a division of labor and I'm producing movies or I'm producing books, I'm producing for the consumptive ends of other people. And so now we have a distinction, right? How exactly do I know what the ends of other people are? How can I weigh off the different ends of different people against each other? How do I know that the consumers value one movie more than another, or one book more than another? I can do this in my own mind for myself, but how do I do it in the social order? And the answer to this, again, or what Mises, the word he used to refer to this is just appraisement. So we have these two different fields of analysis. So let's start with the easy one. This is valuation. And as we go through this, again, we're just going to go through the logic of this and then make some comments about how the Austrian view differs from the mainstream. So we start, of course, with the fundamental fact that only individual human beings act. There are no collective acting agents, and therefore we can't answer this problem about valuing in the division of labor by appealing to some sort of collective valuing. Right? There's neither a collective entity that acts nor a collective valuing process, so to speak, that we could rely upon. The second thing to point out is something Dr. Holtzman mentioned, is this necessity in human action of choice. Since, as we find out very quickly by reflection, as human beings we're finite, that is to say, we can't satisfy our ends just by willing them to be satisfied, right? In other words, when we act, we have a limited effect in attaining our ends, not an unlimited effect. Then means are scarce to us. We have some unmet ends. We have unmet ends because our means are insufficient to attain all of our ends all around at any given moment. We can only attain some of our ends because our means are limited. This, by the way, gives the lie to all the claims about living in a post-scarcity world. It sounds great to live in a post-scarcity world, right? We'd be able to do everything that we wanted to do without limitation. We'd be demigods. But as human beings, well, tough luck for us. We can't do this, right? We're stuck in our human condition, in our finite human condition. Paul Krugman, to the contrary, notwithstanding. Okay, so if it is true that our means are scarce, then, of course, it's also true that we act, and therefore it must be the case that we choose. So if our means are scarce, we can't attain all of our ends. We must be able to choose among the competing ends that we will strive to attain with the limited means at our disposal. So this is where we get logically to the notion of choice. Choice then obviously involves two dimensions. There's the option, the alternative that we prefer more highly, and the alternative that we renounce because we prefer it less highly. So this is important, as Dr. Holtzman pointed out, to always see that because of choice, valuation is always relative. It's always one thing relative to another when we make decisions about what ends will we pursue, what means will we use in the pursuit of these ends. We're not sort of valuing in the abstract. We're valuing with respect to the options that we perceive as available to us and valuable in action. So we have this twofold dimension of valuing. This is where we get to the idea that Austrians call preference. We prefer one option to another. We prefer one movie to another. We prefer coming to the institute for the week as opposed to laying on a beach somewhere, and so on and so forth. So the idea of preference being simply an ordinal rank between options. One thing is better, another thing is not as good. We know that that's logically sufficient for us to choose. Right? We don't need to assign numbers to these choices. We don't need to, in fact, upon reflection, we see that it would be absurd to think of value as a substance. Value is not a substance that has an amount that we can measure and subdivide and apply arithmetic operations to. Value is simply preferring one thing to another, saying that this is better, another thing is not quite as good, or not good at all. Another thing about preference is that preference is, because it's part of choice, it's bound up in action. This is what Rothbard called demonstrated preference. We demonstrate our preferences when we choose and act upon them. And outside of this demonstration of the preferences of other people, we have no objective knowledge of their preferences at all. We have reflective knowledge of our own preferences, but no objective knowledge of other people's preferences outside of their action. So preferences are bound up. That is to say, the objective facts that we use in economic analysis, including preferences of people, are bound up with actions themselves. They're not abstract. They're not separated from the real action of real people. Again, this is a big contrast with the mainstream, of course. You may remember in thinking about or reading about some of the mainstream economists, Paul Samuelson's famous notion of what he called revealed preference, where he said, well, let's assume that people have a preference ordering in their minds and they reveal it over time. So they, over time, the prices change of different goods and they have different income levels, different options available to them. But their preferences are this sort of abstract, fixed rank order of different options that would be mapped out by their actions over time. That's not what the Austrians are saying. The Austrians, again, are causal realists, saying, look, the way human beings really are is that we simply assess our situation of acting. We prefer one option to another. We establish, in other words, our preferences in the situation of acting, and then we act towards the preferred option. Okay, now we get to two critical ideas about valuation. And again, we see some similarities with the mainstream, some differences. And the first is the subjectivity of value. So you've heard this phrase thrown about. And one important thing to mention is that we can talk about subjectivity of value in kind of a generic sense, and then we can talk about it in an analytically precise sense. And Mises gave us this this technical use of the word subjective. And he said the subjectivity of value refers to the fact that value has no extensive property. Value exists in our minds. Value is just a state of our mind. It's a judgment of our mind. It's not a substance. It's just what we think about things. It exists only in our minds. Now, if it exists only in our minds and has no extensive property, then we can't do objective analysis with it, right? We have no common factor that we could use amongst ourselves to define a unit of measure of value. So if I say I get 10 utils of value from eating a chocolate ice cream cone, this is not a scientific, precise statement that measures, saying I have some measurable amount of value. This is just a nonsense statement. Why? Because we can't have a shared notion of what a unit of value is. Even if I could have my own private notion of a unit of value, I can't communicate it objectively to you. You could, again, you could have your own private notion of what a unit of value is, but this would do us no good. We can't compare them. We wouldn't know how they're related to each other. In order to have objective analysis, we have to have a common unit. To have a common unit, we have to have an extensive property that we can independently examine and agree that this would be the unit. This is a foot. This distance from here to here is a kilometer. This weight is 1 pound, and so on and so forth. So it's this limited notion that Austrians are referring to when they talk about the subjectivity of value. Now, obviously, if value is subjective, you can't apply arithmetic operations to it. You can't add values together. You can't subtract one from another. Most importantly, of course, you can't do interpersonal comparisons of value. I can't say that my 10 utils of value from a chocolate ice cream cone is more or less than your 8 utils of value from a vanilla ice cream cone. Right? That's all just nonsense. There's no objective analysis at all here. Now, separate and apart from this notion of subjectivity, this narrow notion of subjectivity, is another aspect of value that we have to be cognizant of, which is that our valuations are not constant. The lack of constancy in our values does not, we don't in technical language refer to that as subjectivity, but that's just another property of our valuing. Our values are not constant. That is to say, there isn't any quantitatively fixed relationship between external factors that influence our value and how we value. So, if the price of gasoline is $3 a gallon, this does not somehow imprint upon my the judgment of my mind some necessary demand for gasoline. There's no quantitatively fixed relationship between the objective features of the world that I value, that influence my action, and the results of my action. Those things are in constant flux. This is what Professor Holtzman pointed out last night when he said that, for, as Mises put it, for Austrian economists, value or preference is the fundamental factor behind which our analysis does not go. Why? Because, well, we simply don't know anything about how these external factors affect our value with respect to our action. There's no, again, we could do history about this, but we don't have economic laws about this, right? Let's say something like, you know, if the price of gasoline goes up by 1%, then of necessity I must buy 0.5% fewer gallons of gasoline. Right? There's no quantitatively fixed relationships. Okay. Now, it should, by the way, the implication of this, of course, is that we can't do functional analysis in economics, because to do mathematical functions, we have to have variables and constants. You know, you've all seen functions, right? The functions have variables and constants. Well, we don't have any constants. You know, the problem in economics isn't that it's sort of hard to find the constants or something. The problem is there are no constants. Everything is a variable. We're speaking again in this limited technical sense, right? The quantitative effect of external phenomena on our actions is not in a constant relationship with our actions themselves. Okay, this is a different. This is not subjectivity. Technically, this is a different principle. The reason to point this out is because the neoclassical economists tend to conflate these two. Instead of seeing that there's a distinction between the two, that we have to deal with them analytically one at a time. And by the way, we'll do this in the lecture on Wednesday, where we take up the further issues in utility theory. We'll talk in great detail about the mainstream approach here and how they try to get around this limitation that seems to come from the existence of human action, this limitation of subjectivity and lack of constants in their utility analysis. Okay, then to just to proceed to the rest of this kind of introductory material on valuing, since in choice we value the option that we're pursuing and we value that against the option that we don't choose. So I have $100 and I go to the clothing store and I buy a jacket for $100. So I'm valuing the jacket relative to what I could buy with $100. Then it's clear that the cost involved in my action is the value of the best alternative course of action I forego. Right? So the same analysis applies to cost that applies to value. It's subjective. It's not constant. It's just the value that I place upon the best alternative that I perceived at the time that I took the action that I chose. Then, of course, we can see that all action must be anticipating a profit, a subjective profit, a difference in value between the option that I choose and the option that I surrender. In other words, we can't imagine a human person who would do contrawise. In every action, we always choose what we perceive to be the more valuable option and set aside the less valuable. That's simply what we mean by preferring one thing to another. It's always consistent with our action. That's what the preference is. It's bound up in our action. And so also is the very notion of profit. Profit is not an invention of the greedy capitalist exploiters who are able to extract somehow profit from the workers. It's a fundamental principle of all human action. And what we need to see as we do economics, of course, is the relationship between these fundamental features of action that we can perceive reflectively by considering our own actions and the bigger world of the market and the division of labor. How are these things related to each other? Okay, and then finally, again, just to get to one other concept here, kind of an introductory concept, is the idea that Mises likes to call economizing. And economizing just refers to the fact that in action, we try to get the most profit that we can. In other words, we take our means and we apply them to the highest valued ends that we perceive at that time of choice. And for any particular end that we pursue, we try to achieve it with the lower valued means. Because if we do these things, we get more valuable ends satisfied. So we're always striving to economize. Where the two aspects of economizing, the value and the cost, are determined by the judgments of our minds. Okay, and this particular slide just shows you the different options on the principle of value imputation. So let's pick up here where Dr. Salerno left off. And you see at the top row is the Austrian view. So we have value starting in the human mind. And then the causal arrow, I guess this way, right? Causal arrow going to the consumer good. So we value, let's say we have a value for having certain internet services provided to us, and so we value the iPad. And then because the iPad has value, we then value the factors of production, the producer goods that can be used to construct an iPad. Right, so the logic of causation of value must move in this unidirectional manner, as Dr. Salerno had it backwards, right? Backwards through the structure of production, and not forward. Now you notice there's seemingly one problem with this. How is it if we say, well, okay, so we have a value in our mind for some benefit, the end that we wish to achieve, and we see that this consumer good is useful in doing this. To use Rothbard's example, simpler example, say, I'm hungry and I want a ham sandwich to nourish my hunger. And then we say, and then the reason that the ham and the bread and the mayo and the lettuce and the cheese and tomato and so on, all the ingredients of the ham sandwich are valuable because I want the ham sandwich. I want to put them together into the consumer good and then eat the consumer good. We seem to have a problem, again, that Dr. Salerno mentioned with the chronology. We don't have a problem in logic, right? We can easily see how the logic of this must flow from the fact that ends and means are related always in this way. In other words, means are only those things in the world that we employ precisely because we think they're helpful in attaining our ends. So the logic of imputation seems, again, impeccable. The problem is it's sort of difficult to see where the chronology of these things occur. Don't I have to produce the ham sandwich first? So where does the chronology come in? What's actually happening first? And again, as Dr. Salerno mentioned, there's this kind of dual causality through time, right? Production first, then valuing back through the structure. But the point is, this seems difficult because don't we have to value things first, chronologically? In order to proceed with production, don't we have to value things first? Don't they already have to be valuable to us? And the answer is surely yes. Now, the resolution to this comes through entrepreneurship. And again, through the week, you'll talk more about this, obviously, but we won't mention it in any detail. But the solution comes in the fact that in this first step, when we say that we have value in our minds, we're thinking about the anticipated value. This is before production. We're thinking, oh, I'd like to have this thing in the future. I could imagine having this good that if I start production today, it would realize my value in that at that future moment. So that's how the reconciliation occurs between the logic and the chronology, right? We have to add in, again, what we know reflectively about all of our actions, which is that we choose to engage in acts of production today in anticipation of the value that we hope to realize in the future. Okay, now the middle row is the classical school, right? Where they said the value is inherent in the producer goods. Value is a feature, a property of producer goods, like energy would be a property of labor, or weight would be a property of a machine, or some other physical aspect of it. So value is simply a feature of the producer good. Then through production, the arrow that goes to the consumer good, that's the arrow of transmitting this value through production to the consumer good. So now the consumer good has a price because it has valuable producer goods embedded in it in production process. And then our minds must assent to this value. So we all agree, oh yes, I see now that the bread is, or the ham sandwich is worth $5 because it has $5 worth of valuable producer goods in it. Again, I won't say any more about this theory except you'll hear more about this again during the week. Just to say, though, that this contradicts the very notion of the relationship that must exist between ends and means. This argument cannot be right because we know through our own reflective knowledge of our own actions that ends always have priority in valuing. The only reason we engage in action is to attain the value of our ends. And therefore, means must have value that's derivative to the value of ends. It can't be any other way, right? And of course, there are nuances in this that will be taken up later. Then the final row... is a neoclassical. This is the mainstream view. Mutual determination, they call this. The Marshallian scissors, right? The two blades of the scissors. There's an objective blade supply is determined by the objective production costs, the objective feat, just like the classical economists would have it. And then the mind, demand, is the subjective part. So you bring the subjective and the objective features of the analysis together in this fashion. Notice the Austrians have a different way of conceiving of this, right? The Austrians say that the human mind is what judges every dimension of acting. You don't, right? This is the way you proceed. You don't say, oh, the human mind just judges the value of the end. And then the means, well, they're real objective things that have an independent effect. No, as Dr. Salona was pointing out, the efficacy of the means in attaining particular ends, like oil in providing gasoline for the ends of driving around an automobile, must first be understood and judged in value by the human mind to become a means. Otherwise, it's just a thing. So again, the main fault of this theory, this claim of the neoclassical economists, is it doesn't take seriously this fundamental connection between ends and means. Means can only have their value assigned to them by the human mind with respect to the ends that are being satisfied. The technical conditions of production have to be analyzed first by the judgment of the mind before they have an effect on our decisions about acting. We may not, someone was asking a question to Dr. Salerno about, wouldn't it be true that workers would hold out for a higher wage if they're engaged in dangerous work? Oh, yes, that's right. The danger of the work, though, doesn't have its own value, right? Some people like dangerous work, and other people don't. And in a market economy, they would self-select into these different areas. So the human mind determines all aspects of human action. There isn't mutual determination. The other problem with mutual determination, again, is a time problem. How exactly then in this argument do you reconcile the mutually determining objective costs of production with the synchronous in time demands of the consumers when the neoclassical economists also argue that the prices of the factors of production are determined by a marginal productivity theory? That labor's wage is determined by the value of the consumer goods it produces. So how can you jointly hold these ideas? And again, later in the week, we may go into this about how the neoclassical economists argue about synchronization of demands and production. That's the main way in which they do this. They say, just every week there's a certain production amount of Big Macs or whatever, and this is coordinated by the market with the weekly demands. And so you get this kind of synchronization of the demand side with the supply side. Okay, now let's go on to appraisement and talk about why it isn't possible for valuation to be used to make decisions, economizing production decisions in the division of labor. And And the reason for this is that we mentioned before, the subjectivity of value doesn't permit us, if we look at the inside first, doesn't permit us to make objective rank orders of the subjective values of different people. So some people like chocolate ice cream more vanilla, others like vanilla more than chocolate. How exactly will we objectively tell whose rank order is more intense, or, you know, whether the if I value chocolate more than vanilla, that outweighs your ranking of vanilla over chocolate? All we know is that we have this rank order and it's reversed. In order for someone to objectively decide whose valuations are more intense, that person would have to be able to experience these valuations in the minds of different people. Now, clearly, no human being can do this. That would be sort of the central planner's solution to this, right? The only other way to solve this problem would be to have us work it out amongst ourselves. We would just, work out a solution amongst ourselves. I would say, I like chocolate more, so I want the resources devoted to chocolate. And you say, vanilla, you want the resources devoted to vanilla. And somehow we work out a compromise or something. But the problem, again, is that the compromise that we might work out, you're stronger than me and you threaten to beat me to a pulp if I don't give in and let you have the vanilla resources, or some other way of solving this problem, doesn't objectively compare our valuations. And again, they're subjective. We have this problem of the impossibility of interpersonal utility comparisons, as the mainstream economists call this. So we can't economize on the ends side by valuation when we're working in the division of labor. Remember, again, because the fundamental problem is we have to compare our valuations. These valuations exist in the minds of different people. We have no way of directly making this comparison. On the means side, how do we arrange our means to ensure that we create the low-cost production methods? We, again, have this fundamental problem. Costs, remember, are simply values. They're just opportunity costs. They're just the subjective value of the alternatives given up. So the central planner, again, is not able to personally value all of the different aspects of the division of labor. That's what we mean by a division of labor, right? That a person is not self-sufficient. In other words, a person isn't doing everything in production. Some people are doing some things, other people are doing other things, and exchange between them. So that option won't work. No single person could ever experience all the operations of the division of labor to weigh them in his own mind. And then the only other option, again, is that we weigh them off against, each one of us does this independently, and then we come together and weigh them our valuations off against each other. So we need a coal miner, and it comes down between you and me. And I say, oh, wait a minute, my opportunity cost for being in the coal mine is way higher than this guy. I've got things to do. Right, I'm not going down in the coal mine. He would say the same thing. No. I'm this valuable. I'm a doctor, and I have all these valuable services. There's no objective way to compare the mental valuations that we're making in our mind against each other. Right? So all these choices are just willy-nilly. They're inefficient. The central planners will choose, but only inefficiently. As Dr. Holzman pointed out, the only efficiency comes from their using the market. Right, so in the old Soviet Union, they would go through the Western catalogs, they would read through the Wall Street Journal and get all the prices, and then make decisions based upon prices. But they could not do this directly in utility terms. Okay, so this is why this is the importance of understanding price theory. Because price theory, that is to say, prices are the solution to this problem. Appraisement is using the technique of arithmetic computation, adding and subtracting and so on, with monetary entries. It's the calculation of net income by using factors of production, producing, bearing the monetary costs, and then taking the output, selling it, receiving the selling receipts, and also net worth of investing in different lines of productive capacity, where we have asset values. This factory is worth such and such in producing this good, so the factory to produce the new iPhone, and it has a certain value as an asset against the liabilities incurred. Right? Asset values exceed liabilities. We know that's a viable investment opportunity. If revenues exceed costs, it's a viable line of production. And entrepreneurs can weigh the actual sums of money against each other. Okay, so our price theory, as the Austrians conceive it, Mises in particular, conceived a price theory as solving this problem. Price theory, the causal realist theory of price, is really the bridge between this analysis of valuing that's common in all action and the same process of decision-making to economize in the division of labor, where we cannot rely upon valuation to solve the problem. We have to have something else. And again, this something else is pricing. And then the next question becomes, well, what prices? Again, the Austrians explain, their theory explains actual market prices. What the price of gasoline is right now at the gas stations here in town, what the price of bread is in the grocery store, what the price of the iPad is, what happens to the price of the iPhone when its antennas defective, and so on and so forth. It's those prices that we're trying to explain. The mainstream tends to focus, Dr. Salerno mentioned the British Classical School tended to focus on long-run prices to the exclusion of actual market prices. Neoclassical economists, again, tend to focus on hypothetical constructs, prices in hypothetical constructs like general equilibrium. And again, okay, you can do a general equilibrium price theory, but what does this have to do with appraisement and the solving of the social problem of deciding how to apply our resources in the way that gets us the greatest human valuations? Okay, so the schematic looks like this. This all in one slide is the connection, the causal connection between preferences and prices. So the Austrians start this way, right? Preferences are the first cause of everything else in the economy. Human valuation, judgments of value, are the cause of all economic action. And our preferences then in the market lead to the supply of consumer goods and demand for consumer goods. And as we interact as buyers and sellers, prices emerge. So we get prices of consumer goods. And then from the prices of consumer goods, the prices of the factors of production are determined. And so the prices of the consumer goods generate revenue for the entrepreneurs who have produced and now are selling these consumer goods. And they generate expenses or costs for the consumers. So we as consumers economize on buying things, as prices move up and down. And the entrepreneurs earn more revenue when prices go up and less when they go down. So it regulates production decisions of the entrepreneurs, their demand for factors of production. So the revenues that we generate as consumers provide the ability of the entrepreneurs to demand the producer goods. So Steve Jobs is raking in the profits from our purchases of the iPhones and iPods and iPads and so on and so forth, all his great products. Then he has the revenue to outbid other entrepreneurs for the factors of production. You can buy up productive capacity. You can hire labor. You can bid the best workers away from other producers, and so on and so forth. So this is where we get the demand for the producer goods. The supply of the producer goods comes from our preferences, right? Directly, again, from our preferences, which jobs we take. We just decide this on the basis of our own human judgments. The compensation we get, the working conditions, and so on. We just judge these, and we prefer one job opportunity to another. And so we supply our labor into those markets. And then supply the producer goods, demand for the producer goods, determine the prices of the factors of production. So we can see that the prices of the factors of production, prices of labor, land, capital goods, are all derived from our demands. And our demands are derived from our preferences. Now, once we have prices of producer goods, then we get costs. So we have the prices, again, wage rates for labor, prices for land, prices for all the capital goods. That then creates certain cost structures for different production techniques. Now the entrepreneur can choose the cost-minimizing production techniques and compare them to the revenue streams from producing these goods. And of course, it's quite complicated. The entrepreneur's decisions here are quite complicated. We don't need to go into these specific complications. Remember, Dr. Holtzman mentioned that economic theory is about what's universally true of all different types of acting. What's universally true of all human action, what's universally true of all buying, what's universally true of all selling, what's universally true about all prices, what's universally true about all profit, and so on and so forth. And not really what is, you know, just contingently true about these particular instances. We're really just after the universal laws that operate. Okay, so then we get the cost for the entrepreneurs, income for the producers, right? The exchange that occurs in the factor markets generates income for us. And then that would loop back. I didn't draw all the arrows of causality, right? But income loops back, so to speak, to our preferences. This would then be part of our choice between the different job opportunities, our choice between buying goods, whether we have a $50,000 income or a $100,000 income, and so on. All right, so this is the whole schematic in one slide. Now, what we're going to deal with for the rest of the time we have here is just the first part of this, just the determination of of consumer goods. And then later in the week, you'll get other talks about the rest of this, entrepreneurship and pricing of capital goods and so on and so forth. Okay, so now let's go to the... example that I have for this. So let's start where Dr. Salerno left off with the laws of utility. So this is where we begin price theory. And in our terminology, we would say that the laws of utility are principles derived logically from these prior principles that we just spoke about, economizing and imputation. And remember, Dr. Salerno already mentioned the logic of this. If I have a unit of a means, if I have a gallon of water, and this is the only supply of water that I have during the day, then I apply it to what I judge to be, in my mind, the highest valued end. As it would be hydrating my body. And so I impute the value of that end, or the helpfulness at least of the gallon of water in attaining that end, to the water itself. So in the desert, as he mentioned, you might give up all your wealth for a gallon of water. In normal situations, you wouldn't, because the stock is different, right? The marginal utility estimate is different. So for one unit of water, we apply it to the highest valued end. This is economizing. We're just doing what we prefer, and then imputing the value to the means. It follows that if I had a second gallon of water, since the first gallon accomplishes my end of hydrating my body, by construction of our analysis, I only want a gallon of water to drink during the day, I must apply the second gallon of water to my second most valuable end. Maybe this is washing my hands during the day and watering my plants, or providing water for my pets, or something of the sort. It must follow then that since this is a less highly ranked end, that I impute less value to the second gallon of water, and so on. This is the law of diminishing marginal utility. Right? The larger the stock of a good, the lower the value of the marginal unit of the good. Then, as Rothbard points out, there's a second law of utility. The second law of utility says the larger the stock of a good, a larger stock of a good is preferred to a smaller stock. That also must be true as long as the thing is a good. As long as I don't go beyond the point of it having marginal utility, then to have another unit of it, to have 4 gallons of water instead of 3 is better than having 3. To have 3 is better than having 2. To have 2 is better than having 1. Obviously, this is so because I can satisfy more ends if I have more of the means. Okay, so given that, and then the possibility of buying and selling, again, we won't go into all the details about this. Time doesn't permit, and you're familiar with this, but we have buying options, and we've introduced money and so on and so forth into these preference ranks. We could imagine a preference rank for a trader that looks something like this. And let's again use Dr. Salerno's example of the household that has an automobile, a Honda Civic in my example. And let's suppose, just for the sake of simplicity of our analysis, let's suppose that this is a used Civic. It's not new, so we don't have to deal with a question of production costs and supply. This is a two-year-old Honda Civic. And so obviously the seller of the Honda Civic is just another regular Joe who owns it and drives it around. It's not Honda, who's worried about production costs and the relationship between revenue and production costs, right? It's just some other guy. And he values in exactly the same way that that the buyer would value the car relative to money. It's just that in exchange, their valuations would be reversed. Again, we're not to that point yet, but you've seen all of this before. So let's suppose, well, we got this one guy, and he's obviously then, let's say he doesn't have a Honda Civic, and he's in the market for one. And this value scale says that he'd be willing to pay $15,000 or less to buy what we're calling the first Honda Civic, the one that he would use to the most important end. That's a commuting to work. And, so if the price happened to be in the market to $15,000 or less, he'd buy this two-year-old Honda Civic. Now, the question is, let's suppose that the price is $15,000 and he buys just one. But in the market, there might be hundreds of these for sale. Why doesn't he buy two? After all, he valued one enough to buy it. He valued a Honda Civic more than the money that he paid to buy it. Well, the law of marginal utility says that the reason he stops buying at some point is because the additional units that he would buy would be worth less to him than the money he gives up. So this marginal utility is working for money too. So his stock of money is declining as he buys the good. Therefore, the marginal utility of his money is rising. The stock of the good is increasing as he buys more, and the marginal utility is falling. At some point, these have to reverse order, right? Where he says, I don't want to buy anymore. Now, notice for this guy, only if the price went to $10,000 or below would he be willing to buy a second Honda Civic. And he would use this Honda Civic for a less valuable use. He would, let his teenage son drive it to school or whatever, or let his friends borrow it during the day when he's at work. Whatever his second most valued use is. If he couldn't think of a third use for the car, again, we're thinking about personal use value here, not having somebody give him 100 cars so he can sell them on eBay, right? He could do that, but we're just thinking of his subjective value. Then, of course, his demand would never go beyond two. Right. Can't think of a way to use the third car. So we can see at different we can just arrange conceptually then a demand schedule from this this constructed ordinal ranking. Well, we could see that if the price happened to be $16,000, he'd be bid out of the market by guys willing to pay more. If the price were $15,000, he'd buy one. If it were $11,000, he'd still just be buying one. But if the price fell to $10,000, he'd buy two. So we see the law of demand, right? The law of demand is a necessary logical implication of diminishing marginal utility. Now, just to be clear on this, the law of demand is not empirical in this sense. It doesn't provide us with empirical evidence over time about what a person will do in buying a good today and buying the good next week when the price is different. It only tells us what the person would logically have to do at the moment he chose to buy the good if the price were different. It says, if the price were, $16,000, this guy would not buy. But if instead, at that same moment of choice, the price happened to be $15,000, he would buy. And if at that same moment of choice, if the price happened to be $10,000, he would buy two instead of one. So note it's a conjecture, if you will. The law of demand is a conjecture about what this person would do if the price were different, but nothing else were different. Sometimes in economics, we call this ceteris paribus. Right? Other things the same. If the price were the only thing that were different in this buying situation, what would the buyer do? And the answer is, he'd only buy more units at a lower price. So that's the law of demand. Notice we can use exactly the same preference rank for supply. All we have to do is put this hypothetical person in a different initial situation. What if we had a guy who owned two Civics? What if he already owns the first and the second civic? So they're already on his preference rank. And now he's ranking them against money, thinking, well, you know, if some guy comes along and offers me these sums of money, I'm certainly willing to exchange at some price, right? I'm willing to sell my car. And I'm just assuming, for the sake of simplicity, not have to put up another slide, that the preference rank is exactly the same as the buyer. So in that case, well, at $10,000, he'll hold on to both of his civics, right? Because he values even the second one more than $10,000. But if the price instead, if the offer in the market happened to be $12,000, he'd sell the second Civic. And again, the question arises, why doesn't he sell both? Why does he hold back? Why does he keep some of his stock of the good? After all, he sold one of the units at the price of $12,000. Why doesn't he sell everything? And the answer is, he has a more valuable use for the first one. Right? He wants to hold on to that for to apply it to a higher use value, a higher end that he has in mind. And therefore, only at higher prices will he supply more. So that you've given him incentive and bid away that more highly valued use. He'll sell off the car that's, you know, he lets his teenager drive to school, but he'll keep the one he uses for commuting, unless you pay him more than 16. You pay him 16 or above, he'll sell that one too. And then maybe find cheaper transportation or do something else, right? We're not involved, again, in the contingent features of this. We're just involved in the logic of it. So we can chart out a supply schedule for what this guy would do if he were a seller. And we see the law of supply, right? Low prices, he sells fewer units. Only at higher prices does he sell larger units. Now, when we think about the price, here we can take an intermediate step. It's sort of unnecessary, but we might do this just for completeness. What if these were really two different people? So we had one buyer that looked like this and one seller that had a schedule just like this. And they find out about each other. Remember, again, for economic activity to take place, the persons involved must know about these opportunities, right? They must know about the means and opportunities for action. What if they meet and they find out that they're in a position to trade? Well, then we can say something about the price, right? We can say that the price, if they find each other and they learn about their valuations, they can see that there's mutual benefit in making a trade between the two of them, as long as the price is right, as long as they can agree on a mutually advantageous price. This price would have to be somewhere above $11,000 and below $15,000, right? In that range of price, they could make a deal at $12,000, at $13,000, at $14,000. Right? So far we've seen that the diminishing marginal utility, since it's operating on both sides of the market, both the buyer and the seller, set certain limitations on what the price can be. Of course, it could be that the two people meet and they find that there's no mutual advantage in trade. That could happen too, right? But we don't need to explain things that don't exist. We're trying to explain trade and prices that do exist. So when prices do exist and trade does exist, well, it must be the case that we've got a mutual, they both perceive their advantage in trading at this particular price. It's the laws of diminishing marginal utility that create this zone of mutual benefit in price. Okay, I can take one quick question. They have the same, by my construction, they're the same value scale, but they start with different endowments of cars. So that's what creates the difference in marginal utility. In the real world, of course, we all have different value scales too. So yeah, you're quite right to point that out. Okay, so here we would just get a range in which price must fall. Theory would only tell us price must fall, you know, somewhere between the minimum amount the seller is willing to accept and the maximum amount the buyer is willing to pay. That's not particularly insightful, but it's somewhat helpful. Notice what we're missing in this market, though, is competition. Right? We have we just have one buyer and one seller. That's why we get a zone of indeterminacy. If we had competing buyers and competing sellers, really one or the other, then this zone of indeterminacy would be diminished, right? And the price would be completely determined at some point where the mutual advantage of the traders is exhausted. So let's look at that case. And so in this case, I've added a couple of buyers and a couple of sellers. That wouldn't be necessary. We could just have competition on one side of the market and have a determined price. But let's suppose we have this market. So we have three guys with Honda Civics to sell. They each own one. And we have three buyers, and the three buyers don't own none of them own their first Honda Civic, their most valued Civic, so they're in the market. And notice they're arranged, their preferences are different this time, and I've arranged them in the order of most eager to least eager, we might call it, or most willing to least willing a buyer and seller. So person A is the most willing buyer. Right? He could outbid the other two if there were just one Honda Civic available from the sellers, and he's willing to pay the highest price. He's willing to pay 15. Buyer B is only willing to pay 13. Buyer C is only willing to pay 11. And the same for the sellers. Seller X is the most eager seller. He would be the most likely to sell because he can undercut the others just because he prefers the money more eagerly than the Civic, right? He's willing to accept $11,000 to sell the Civic. But seller Y won't sell unless he gets a price of 13. So he could undercut Y. And seller Z is the least eager of the three. Now, again, we're just saying empirically this happens to be true, right? In markets, there's a diversity of preferences. We find different people with different preferences. What happens when they all come together and exchange? And the answer is, what happens is we reach what Austrians call the market clearing price. The determined price, right? This is the price, $13,000 in my example, where the quantity demand and the quantity supplied are the same. Now, to say that the quantity demand and quantity supplied are the same is just technical talk. That means, in this case and in only this case, the greatest values in the market are satisfied. The reason why this price emerges and not another one is because at this price, more people attain their ends and attain their ends of greater value than at any other price. For example, what if the price were higher? What if the price were $14,000? Well, at $14,000, as we saw before, we only get one buyer. Only buyer A wants to buy. And we get two willing to sell. X and Y want to sell. And so one of the sellers is unsatisfied with this, right? There is, in fact, a mutually advantageous trade that can take place between buyer B and seller Y that does not take place if the price is too high. This is not economizing. There's some unexploited actions that could be taken here for mutual benefit. That's precisely why the market clearing price and not prices above it emerge. By the way, the other reason that reinforces this is expectations, anticipations, entrepreneurship. This is why in the market, sellers and buyers don't have to go through a long and torturous process of trial and error. Because we have entrepreneurship, we can anticipate what will happen if we ask prices at this level or bid prices at that level. We can anticipate in advance and avoid the errors that are associated with, for a seller, with pricing our product too high, or as a buyer, with making an offer that's too low. Now, we don't do this perfectly, again. There are errors in our action. But at least there is a human factor that regulates the errors that we make, that minimizes them, seeks to minimize them. The same thing then would, or a similar thing would happen if the price were too low. Right? The price is not too low. It's not below market clearing, precisely because if it were, there would be buyers who would be unsatisfied. They don't want to be unsatisfied. Right? They want their ends to be satisfied. And so will they just sort of foolishly stick to this low price of $12,000? No. They'll up the bid. They'll raise the price. Why? Because they're willing to do this. Their preferences are such that they're willing to pay the higher price to buy the good. When they do this, they draw in another seller. And then the market clears. Okay, now one last thing I'll say about this, just to summarize, again, the distinctive feature of this, because if you've had some economics before, some of this looks familiar, right? We work with supply and demand. We have, utility or preference, and so it looks kind of like the mainstream. But again, to reemphasize, the Austrian, one of the distinctive features of the Austrian view here is that When we talk about market clearing prices or equilibrium prices, if you will, these are the actual prices of goods. The actual prices of goods and factors of production in the world as it exists right now. These prices are, in fact, clearing the market right now. Now, it may be that people think as they trade at these prices, they think later on that they mistakenly traded, but right now their preferences are such that these prices do, in fact, clear the market. Now, why are these prices then the important things to explain? Well, as we mentioned before, we want in the causal realist tradition to explain the real world. We want to explain these prices are part of the real world, so we want to explain them. And second of all, these are the prices that entrepreneurs work with to make production decisions in the division of labor. These are the relevant prices for economic calculation and appraisement. And therefore, these need to be explained, not, again, hypothetical prices of the long run far, far away or of the general equilibrium never, never land. Okay, at this point, I'll stop. Thank you.